Okay, so have you ever actually tried reading the Song of Songs in the Bible?
Oh, it's an experience.
It is. It's like this whirlwind of imagery and passionate language, but figuring out what it all means can feel like solving a puzzle.
A puzzle where you don't even have the picture on the box.
Exactly. So that's what we're going to try to do today, solve the puzzle. We're going to dive into the Song of Songs, specifically looking at its structure.
Through a really interesting lens.
Yes, we're going to be drawing from a lecture by Dr. Lloyd Carr.
Oh, he's great.
He is. Have you heard him speak before?
Yeah, I have. He brings this fresh perspective to how the Song of Songs is organized. It's really fascinating.
It really helps clear up some of the mysteries around the book. I feel like by the end of this deep dive, we're going to be able to understand it on a whole new level.
Oh, absolutely.
So to start us off, let's talk about the structure of the Song of Songs, because that has been debated for centuries,
Oh,
right?
yeah. Big debates.
Some scholars think it's just a collection of individual love poems.
With like a common theme?
Right. But others think there's a more unified structure to the whole book.
Yeah. Where does Dr. Card stand on this?
That's what I want to know. Where does he stand? Is it random poems, or is there some kind of intentional structure?
He definitely thinks there's a deliberate structure, like a real intentionality behind it. He
Interesting.
points to these repetitions, these recurring motifs, all these little clues that weave the text together.
That makes sense. I mean, it is in the Bible.
Right.
A lot of thought went into how those books were put together.
Absolutely.
So, what kind of structure does he see?
He proposes a chiastic structure.
A chiastic structure.
Yeah.
Remind me what that is again?
Okay, so it's actually a pretty common technique in biblical texts. Think of it like an X.
Okay, an X.
The elements in the first half of the text are mirrored in the second half.
So it's symmetrical.
Exactly, a symmetrical pattern around a central point.
So what's the central point in the Song of Songs?
Dr. Carr identifies verses 4.16 and 5.1 as the central pivot point. Get this. There are
Okay.
exactly the same number of verses before and after this point.
Whoa, that's so cool. So it's like the text is drawing our attention to this central axis.
Right.
Okay, I'm getting it. So how does this X shape or this chiastic structure actually play out in the book? Does Dr. Carr divide the Song of Songs into different sections based on this?
He does, yeah. He divides it into five distinct units.
5 units. So it's kind of like a five-act play about love.
You could say that? Yeah, kind of. Act one, or unit one, covers 1.2 to 2.7.
Okay.
He calls this unit anticipation.
Anticipation.
It's all about the lovers longing for each other, looking forward to when they can finally be together.
Makes sense. Anticipation is a big part of love.
It is. And it's interesting because each of these units actually ends with a specific phrase. It's almost like a refrain in a song.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I get like a recurring theme. Unit one concludes with this plea: "Stir not up nor awaken love until it please."
So they're basically saying, let love unfold naturally. Don't rush it.
Precisely. Now, unit two, which covers 2.8 to 3.5,
Okay.
he calls it found and lost and found, which pretty much sums it up.
Yeah.
You have those initial encounters, then separation, and then that joyful reunion. And guess what?
What?
It ends with the same phrase: "Stir not up nor awaken love."
So that theme of patience and anticipation, it's carrying through.
It is, yeah. Now, unit three is called consummation.
Ooh, getting to the good stuff.
It comes from 3.6 to 5.1, and it focuses on the lovers finally coming together, like becoming one.
Okay.
Dr. Carr even suggests that it might actually depict a wedding procession.
Oh, wow. A celebration of their love.
Exactly.
Interesting that this unit doesn't end with that stir not up phrase, though, right?
Right. The anticipation has built. They're ready to express their love now.
So the structure is actually giving us clues about the emotional arc of the story.
It is. It totally is. And then we move on to unit four,
Okay.
which covers 5.2 to 8.4.
All right.
He calls this one losing, and it actually mirrors unit two.
Oh, interesting. So we're back to separation and searching.
Exactly. They're facing challenges, things that test their bond. But even with all that, the unit ends with that familiar refrain.
Stir not up nor awaken love until it please.
Yeah. It's like a reminder that true love endures,
Even through tough times.
even through tough times. So the structure is highlighting this cyclical nature of love, right?
Yeah, the ups and downs, periods of togetherness and separation.
Exactly. Now, unit five, this is the grand finale.
Okay, hit me with it.
It runs from 8.5 to the end of the book.
All right.
This one is all about affirmation, reaffirming their commitment, how strong their love is.
So I bet it ends with, stir not up nor awaken love until it please again, right?
It echoes the sentiment, but it uses different imagery.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Remember the Unit 1 began with the woman longing for her lover's kiss?
Uh-huh.
Unit 5 concludes with a similar image, so it brings the whole story full circle.
Oh, wow. I hadn't even noticed that. So Dakarhar is using this chiastic structure to really drive home the point that the Song of Songs is not just a bunch of random poems thrown together.
Right. It's carefully crafted. There's a real message about love here.
Yeah, I'm starting to see how understanding the structure can unlock the meaning of the Song of Song.
It's like a key.
It is, and there's even more to discover because Dr. Carr points out these recurring words and images that connect the units.
Oh, yeah, like little threads woven throughout.
Like what? What are some examples?
Well, he talks about gazelles and stags, which symbolize the beauty and swiftness of the beloved.
That's like a secret code embedded in the poetry.
Exactly. Another example he gives is this imagery of the House of Wine.
House of Wine?
It appears in 2.4.
Oh, right. And you were saying that that phrase could have multiple meanings.
It could, yeah. Depending on how you interpret it.
Like what? Give me an example.
Well, Dr. Carr suggests it could refer to a vineyard or a place where wine is consumed, like a tavern. Each adds a different nuance.
So even a single phrase like House of Wine can have so much depth.
So much depth. That's what makes the Song of Songs fascinating.
We've uncovered the secret language, and now we're starting to understand what it's saying.
Exactly. And Dr. Carr's structural analysis, it gives us the tools to decode that language.
I love it. I'm already seeing how much richer our understanding of the Song of Songs can be when we pay attention to its structure. But before we move on, can we quickly recap what we've learned so far, just to make sure everyone's on the same page?
Sure. So we've learned that Dr. Carr believes the Song of Songs has this X-shaped structure called a chiasm. It's divided into 5 units, each with a theme, and marked by that phrase, stir not up nor awaken love until it please. Dr. Carr also highlights recurring images like gazelles and the House of Wine that add to the beauty and meaning.
Beautiful summary. It's like we're putting together a puzzle, we've got all these pieces, and we're starting to see how they fit.
We are. But we're not done yet.
We're not.
The big question is, what does this structure tell us about the meaning of the Song of Songs? Like, what's the point of it all?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It is.
And one that we'll definitely tackle next time. Stay tuned. Welcome back. We left off last time talking about the Song of Songs and how it has this really cool structure, an X shape, a chiasm.
Right.
And Dr. Carr breaks the book down into 5 units based on this structure. But what Wing I keep thinking about is how Dr. Carr says there's no consensus on how many characters are even in the Song of Songs. I mean, how can we divide it into these neat little units if we don't even know who's speaking?
It's a good question, but I think it's important to remember that we're dealing with poetry here.
Right.
Poetry is often open to multiple interpretations. So even though there might be debate about the characters or how many speakers there are, Dr. Carr's analysis helps us to see the overall movement of the text.
Okay. So it's less about knowing exactly who is saying what and more about understanding the bigger picture, the shape of the whole thing.
Exactly. Think of it like watching a dance.
A dance.
Yeah. You don't need to know the dancers' names or their exact relationship to each other to appreciate the beauty of the choreography.
That's a great analogy.
You can still see the patterns, the repetition, the emotional arc of the performance.
Yeah, I like that.
And one of the most interesting parts of this dance is the presence of the Daughters of Jerusalem.
Oh, right. Those mysterious women.
Yeah. We touched on them briefly last time, but I think it's worth spending a little more time with them because they're so intriguing.
Yeah, I agree. We still haven't really figured out who they are or what their purpose is.
Well, that's part of the mystery, isn't it? They're like this Greek chorus commenting on the action, adding another layer of interpretation. But who they are exactly, that's up for debate.
What are some of the theories?
Some scholars see them as just a literary device, you know, to highlight the woman's voice.
Okay.
Or to represent society's expectations around love and relationships.
Uh-huh.
But others think they could be potential rivals for the lover's affection, adding a bit of tension and jealousy to the story.
Ooh, a love triangle.
Possibly. It's fun to speculate. But either way, their presence makes us think about the social pressures surrounding this love story. You know, love isn't just this abstract feeling. It exists in a community.
That's true. It's always shaped by the world around us.
Exactly. And that brings us to another big debate surrounding the Song of Songs.
Hit me.
Who are the lovers? And what does their relationship actually represent?
Right, because we know the woman is called the Shulamite. But beyond that, it's kind of a mystery who she is and what her relationship to the man symbolizes.
Right. Some people read it as a straightforward love story, just two people in love.
Uh-huh.
But many scholars see it as an allegory.
An allegory?
Yeah, like a story with a hidden meaning.
Okay, so what's the hidden meaning?
Well, the most common allegorical interpretation is that the Shulamite represents Israel, the chosen people of God.
Okay.
and her lover represents God himself. So the whole book becomes this extended metaphor for God's love for his people.
So the passionate language, the longing, the separation and reunion, it's all reflecting the ups and downs of Israel's relationship with God.
Yes, exactly.
That's a pretty powerful interpretation.
It is, and it helps explain why the Song of Songs has been so important in both Jewish and Christian traditions.
Because it's seen as this really beautiful expression of divine love.
Yes, it goes beyond just a human love story.
Wow, I'm starting to see how one book can have so many layers of meaning.
It's a love story, yeah. But also maybe an allegory, a reflection on faith, the human condition.
It's all of those things. That's kind of what makes it so captivating.
It really is. And it makes you think about that phrase Dr. Carr points out, stir not up nor awaken love until it please.
Right. We were talking about how it emphasizes patience.
Yes. But if you look at it through that allegorical lens, it takes on a whole new meaning.
What do you mean?
Well, if the Song of Songs is about God's love for Israel, that phrase becomes about awe, reference, like recognizing that God's love is so powerful, so big, that you can't force it or manipulate it. It has to be received, accepted on its terms.
I can see how that would resonate with people of faith.
It has for centuries. And it's another example of how the structure of the Song of Songs helps us unlock deeper layers of meaning.
So we've got this incredible structure, that recurring phrase, and the mystery of who the characters represent. Is there anything else Dr. Carr has uncovered?
Oh, tons. He also points to recurring imagery and these motifs that weave throughout the text. We touched on the House of Wine last time.
Oh, yeah, I love that one. It's in the first unit, right, where the woman describes how her lover brought her to the House of Wine.
Exactly. It's such a romantic scene. And her lover's banner over her was love. But remember how we were saying that the phrase House of Wine could have multiple interpretations?
I do. And each interpretation kind of brings out different shades of meaning.
Exactly. Like on the most basic level, it could just refer to a vineyard.
Right. A place where grapes are grown. It's a very sensual image.
Very lush vines, warm sun. But it could also represent a wine press.
A wine press.
Mm-hmm. The place where the grapes are crushed to make wine.
Right. So that adds a whole other layer.
It does. Because it suggests a process of refinement.
Like how love can be tested and changed over time.
Exactly. It's not just about that initial sweetness. It's about the deeper, richer flavor that develops as love goes through the wine press of life.
I love that. But I think you said there's a third interpretation too.
I did. Some scholars think House of Wine could refer to a cavern, you know, a place where people gather.
So it's less about the wine itself and more about the social aspect.
Right. It suggests that their love isn't just this private affair. It's something to be shared and celebrated.
Oh, I like that. It brings in this community aspect. Like, love is the binding force that brings people together.
It is. And that reminds us of the whole point of a Song of Songs, that love is meant to be joyful, celebratory, life-giving.
Wow. So even one little phrase can have so much depth and meaning.
Exactly. And that's just one small example.
I know.
Dr. Carr's analysis helps us appreciate all these details and how they contribute to the bigger picture.
This has been so great. I feel like I'm seeing the Song of Songs with new eyes.
Me too. It's always an adventure to dive back into this book.
So in the next part, are we going to look at some specific passages and how Dr. Carr breaks them down?
We are. He does it recurring symbols, specific words and phrases, all those little details that add up to something much bigger.
Can't wait. Stay tuned, listeners, because we're going even deeper into the Song of Songs. Welcome back to our deep dive into the Song of Songs. We've been talking about this book's structure, all the hidden layers. It's been pretty amazing.
I know, right? Dr. Carr's insights are just wow.
Totally. Like, he's given us this new way of looking at it.
He has. It's like he's handed us a map to this incredibly beautiful and complex world.
Exactly. And I'm really excited in this last part to, like, zoom in on some specific passages.
Oh, yeah. Get into the nitty-gritty.
Yeah. See how all those little details work together? Because we've been talking about these bigger themes and the overall structure. But I think it's time to get our hands dirty.
Let's do it. Where do you want to start?
Well, we keep coming back to this phrase, stir not up nor awaken love until it please.
Right. That's a big one.
It appears at the end of several units, and it's just really stuck with me. Can we dig into that a little bit more?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a phrase that's been debated for centuries, right?
Yeah. It seems so simple on the surface, but...
But there's so much packed into it, like this idea of waiting, being patient, letting love unfold naturally.
Not forcing it.
Not forcing it, exactly.
And I remember you were saying how it takes on a whole new meaning when we think about the allegorical interpretation of the Song of Songs.
Right.
Where the Shulamite represents Israel and her lover represents God.
Yeah, it becomes even more powerful in that context. Because it's not just about human love anymore.
Right, it's about something much bigger.
It's about this awe-inspiring divine love that's just... It's so profound, you can't earn it. You can't demand it.
You have to just be open to receiving it.
Exactly.
It makes me think about how sometimes in our own lives, we try to force things to happen, you know, especially in relationships.
Oh, all the time.
We get impatient. We want love on our own terms. But the Song of Songs reminds us that sometimes the best thing we can do is just surrender, let go of control.
Yeah. Trust in something bigger than ourselves.
That's beautifully put. Okay, I'm also really curious about the imagery of the House of Wine, which we talked about last time.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
It appears in the first unit, and it just seems like such a key symbol.
It is. And, you know, as we discussed, it could be interpreted in a few different ways, which is what I love about it.
Yeah, it's like this multi-layered symbol.
Exactly. So on one level, it could be a literal vineyard.
Right. That image of those rolling hills, lush vines, sun-drenched grapes, it's very sensual.
Very. It connects the lover's passion to nature, to abundance.
But then you're saying it could also represent a wine press.
Right. And that interpretation brings in this idea of transformation, refinement.
Because the grapes are crushed in the wine press to make wine.
Exactly. So it's like love is being tethered, pressed, purified.
Ooh, I love that.
It's not always easy, right?
No, it's not. Love can be messy and challenging.
But that's part of the process. That's how it becomes something deeper, richer.
Like those grapes being transformed into this amazing wine.
I love that analogy. And then, of course, there's the third interpretation of the House of Wine.
As a tavern.
Yes, where people gather and celebrate. It brings in a more social element.
It's not just about the lover's private world anymore. It's about love's power to bring people together, to create joy, to foster connection.
Exactly. It reminds us that love isn't meant to be hidden away. It's meant to be shared and celebrated with the world.
This has been such a mind-blowing journey. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us. I feel like I have a whole new appreciation for the Song of Songs now.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure to explore with you.
And to all our listeners out there, if you've never read the Song of Songs before, I highly encourage you to check it out. Don't be intimidated by its reputation as a challenging text. Just approach it with curiosity and an open mind.
It's a book that can speak to you on so many levels.
Absolutely. You might find it surprisingly relevant to your own experiences of love and longing and the search for connection.
And if you're feeling really adventurous, try reading it through the lens of Dr. Carr's structural analysis. It might just blow your mind.
It blew mine. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the Song of Songs. It's been a real pleasure. Until next time, keep exploring and keep diving deep.